You're listening to The Luxury Item, the podcast on the business of luxury and the people and companies that are shaping the future of the luxury industry. Here's your host, Scott Kerr.
The fact that upstart streetwear labels and storied luxury brands are becoming ever closer entwined is obvious to anyone with even a minor interest in menswear. It's a trend that's been building for around a decade, and that relationship has been evolving and fast. A year ago, High Snobiety published The New Luxury, a white paper that offers insight into the luxury mindsets of millennials and Generation Z. These are the consumer segments that drove most of all luxury growth and are predicted to make up half of the luxury market. The key takeaway from the white paper is that consumer segments have changed, and with that, the very definition of luxury. That streetwear and sneakers not only infiltrated the upper tiers of fashion, but became it. One person who can give us the lowdown on what's going on comes right from the source. My guest today on The Luxury Item is Jeff Carvalho, co-founder of High Snobiety, the lifestyle platform that has become the media authority on streetwear and youth culture. High Snobiety has been around for 15 years and covers forthcoming trends and news in fashion, design, music, and culture. It has steadily built a strong brand in the online fashion and lifestyle world and has become a global source for inspiration. Founded by David Fisher in 2005 as a niche German-based sneaker blog, the High Snobiety website now boasts over 9 million unique visitors every month. Jeff Carvalho joined in 2007 to not only oversee the website, but to grow the business and brand partnerships, and that he did. The High Snobiety business has expanded into print, events, a creative agency, and an online shopping platform. Its headquarters are based in Berlin, with offices in Los Angeles, London, Hong Kong, Tokyo, and New York. High Snobiety's mission is to turn curious outsiders into cultivated insiders. Jeff Carvalho is already one of those certified cultivated insiders. He's a leading authority on the state of street style and its influence on culture, and is often asked to comment by the New York Times, The Business of Fashion, and other places on this growing market and its influence on fashion and luxury on a broader scale. Welcome to The Luxury Item, Jeff.
How are you? Thanks for having me, Scott.
Thanks for coming on. Well, you're really no stranger to podcasting. You've been podcasting since it was cool.
I think it was podcasting before it was cool.
So when did you start podcasting? Like 2005?
Yeah, 2005. I think we've talked about this before. I'm really obsessed with platforms. And when podcasting came around, and certainly when Apple began supporting podcasts within the old iTunes system, it became really an attractive way to begin sharing messages and conversation around a lot of the work that I've done and the things that I've been studying. And, you know, in 2005, podcasting was quite different than it is today. You know, we certainly had the Serial podcast had its moment, which really, really brought podcasting to the forefront. A lot has changed since then, but yeah, certainly I've been podcasting since at least 2005, and it's incredible just how far it's come.
What was your first podcast on?
So we had a podcast called The Weekly Drop, which is, it's an interesting name because the word drop is so much part of the vernacular
of everything.
Of everything today. Right. So, you know, I'll give myself a little bit of credit for thinking about that word early on, but it was a podcast that covered the moment. In many ways, the way High Snobiety covers the moment today within fashion and style and what's happening in youth culture. And if you can think of blogging, traditional blogging, a decade or more ago, where, you know, you put up a snippet of news and you had a photograph of maybe a new sneaker. What we did was simply extend the story to go beyond just the product and began inviting a lot of the creators and people that were making change in the industry to have a longer conversation. So I like to say that where High Snobiety was fast news around street fashion and sneakers and style, Weekly Drop was this complement to it. Even though they were not related at the time, where we would take a lot of, inspiration from what was there and invite some of those creatives on to talk. So, you know, I remember some of the earlier some of the earliest podcasts we have were with, you know, artists like Lupe Fiasco before he became big. And we went deep into finding a lot of, say, the godfathers or forefathers of the modern street fashion movement. Guys like Eric Brunetti and Rick Klotz, these are names that would be very familiar to students of street fashion. You know, they developed brands in the late 80s and 90s that were quite influential, not only in the world I lived in, but certainly within the world of skate and music. So what I like to say is that we were really the first to invite this new creative class that in many ways was part of, you know, a subculture, was part of an underground, and really tried to give these creators a voice to talk about themselves. And what Weekly Drop, the thing that I'm most happy about what Weekly Drop did was that it allowed for, you know, new young creatives to actually hear from sometimes their heroes and others as to how they got their start. And, you know, we've come a long way with the internet, especially with social media and how quick things are.
Yeah, and the whole idea of streetwear has come a long way since 2005. I was
really, totally.
Yeah, I mean, congratulations on that Heist Nobody's Blank Staples capsule collection with H&M. How did that whole thing come about?
So thank you for that. We've been in commerce full on for, I want to say, about 2.5 years now. For the better part of our history, we were very good at telling people where to buy things. Actually, I'll even step back. For a long time, it was very difficult to tell people where to buy things because many of the goods that we covered were very localized. Again, you know, pre-social media, you may have to, you know, visit a store somewhere in the world to go pick up an item or a specific colorway of a product. And then, of course, you know, online commerce took off. So we really have supported a tremendous number of brands who have gone online in offering their goods. And, you know, 2 years ago, we began to understand that, you know, the majority of our readers are coming to us, of course, for breaking news and conversation and editorial around street fashion and things that encompass that. Because it's not just about sneakers. It's not just about clothes. It's about maybe a mindset, if I can say that. And we said, you know, they're coming to us for this, and more than ever, they're asking us also for Heist Nobody branded products. So why don't we dip our toes into that? So the Staples collection, which we're now working with H&M on, is a way of taking basics and elevating them to another place. I always like to say, and David Fisher, who's the founder of Heist Nobody, loves to say that what makes style and fashion so interesting is not, you know, something that's over designed. In fact, the things that are mostly simply designed, and it's the subtleties that you see in it that allow you to understand a premium garment versus, say, maybe a standard traditional basic garment. So a lot of the staple collection that we're doing ourselves and with H&M is exactly that. It's taking basics and elevating them to a more premium version of what they are. And again, to the average person, when you look at it, you know, you may not see it, but once you touch it, there's a certain hand feel to it. And certainly, you know, these are goods that we ourselves stand very much behind. So it's been a really interesting journey around Staples. The one thing I'll add too, especially with H&M and the work that we're doing there, is just how much of a demand there is for it now. And the more that we think about, and certainly more as the world begins to think about what responsible consumption looks like and certainly responsible commerce looks like, it's no longer just about, you know, a disposable t-shirt that you buy in a 3-pack at a local shop. And you can do that. You know, you certainly can. It's about items and even the basic items that remain in your closet, and, you know, they stay with you for some time and you're not just throwing them away once they're done because, you know, the higher the quality, the better it is.
Yeah. It seems like something new for H&M. They seem to be starting to do more collaborations in the streetwear area. I don't know if they've done this before. Ring a bell.
Yeah,
I think they're doing something with Kangol as well. So
sure.
Is this something new for them?
In fact, it's not. You know, H&M has been, along with other retailers, they've understood the power of collaboration just as much as, you know, the world of street fashion. And, you know, the word collab or collabos has always been part of the vernacular of streetwear. You know, a collaboration used to be in some ways a cosign. You would take maybe an upstart brand and team them up with an established brand, and that cosign of that established brand working with that smaller brand is what helped elevate them. H&M actually took it to a different level completely. What they would do is actually go to the high-end luxury designers and say, look, you've had quite an offering, especially an upscale offering. Let's take some of that design language and make it much more accessible. And H&M has done that with a variety of partners. Let me just take a double check here, make sure I got my language right. Yeah, you know, the one that comes to mind is the H&M Maison Margiela collection that came out around 2012. So it's one of many collaborative moments that H&M has had, and certainly other retailers have done it too. And yeah, I think again, it's being able to take the very best of maybe the high end luxury space, and take some of those products and make them much more accessible to a traditional consumer. And quite honestly, it works very well.
Yeah. You know, it seems like street fashion is going through some weird phase these days. Like a year ago, you know, the men's retail community was abuzz at the prospect of tailored clothing rebounding. And some even said that streetwear was dead. But fast forward to today, when the coronavirus pandemic stopped business in its track and left everyone working from home in their street fashion. So when the situation finally normalizes and men are returning to offices, whenever that may be, so do you think the new business casual will be have some more street fashion elements to it?
The trend is definitely going that way, and it certainly has gone that way with footwear. You know, it's very commonplace to see a high-end pair of trainers. You know, Common Projects is certainly one of the innovators in that space, and not innovating and say taking a white tennis shoe, but taking that white tennis shoe, making it in Italy with the best leathers and elevating it to something else. And, you know, it's a safe place to play today. It's very safe for businessmen to be able, excuse me one second. Sorry, I've got a crying baby here.
No worries, we're all living through it.
You know, I think it started with footwear. The casualness of the office is certainly changing. And you're absolutely right. I think, you know, in the age of COVID, we're all used to wearing a very specific thing in our homes. You know, and one of my favorite things to read is about, you know, all of these trend analysts and stylists that are recommending that people dress up in their homes. I mean, how many of us really want to do that? But, you know, what I will say is that the, you know, street fashion or streetwear making its way into the offices is probably not something that's going to be, you know, it's not going to be as sort of over obvious. I think what we need to know is that street fashion just doesn't encompass, say, t-shirts and jeans and sneakers. It's become more than that. And what you're doing is what the industry is doing is taking notes from street fashion and applying it to traditional menswear today. And quite honestly, tailoring is a part of that. You know, it's all come together. In 2007, 8, 9, right as that recession was happening here in the United States, there was a menswear movement that was budding and growing. There was a variety of certainly websites like A Continuous Lean and a variety of blogs that were covering this. And it became very safe for guys to say dress up. But, you know, there's only so many brogue shoes that somebody wants to wear, right, before things get a little bit uncomfortable.
Right.
By the way, there's plenty of pretty comfortable brogues out there. But I think the casualness is coming, and it's become more of a safe place. And more than anything, I think the market is taking hints from street fashion in the comfort side of things.
Let's go back a little bit, because there might be some listeners who are not familiar with High Snobiety. It grew out of a niche sneaker blog that launched in 2005 by David Fisher. And back then, sneaker culture and streetwear weren't really a thing. And as for social media at that time, you know, I think Facebook and YouTube had just launched and Twitter was just a glimmer in somebody's eye. So how did High Snobiety take off from there?
It's a great question. You know, there was quite an amount of work that David and our, you know, myself and our team have put into it over the last, I think I want to say we're at 16 or 17 years now. No, I'm sorry. We're at 15 years this year. I apologize. Sorry. I'm getting ahead of myself. I have been with High Snobiety about 14 years now. Mm-hmm. First of all, we have to keep in mind the pace of publishing during, you know, the glory years of blogging, and not just in streetwear, but also in other markets like tech. You know, High Snobiety came out of a model that Gizmodo and Engadget had really set. And that was, you know, product news blogging, you know, the latest phone that was coming out, the latest new technology, the latest DVD player, TV. You know, there was a land war going on, or I guess a digital war going on between the outlets that were covering this stuff. You know, if you looked at CES back then, these guys were, you know, pioneers in bringing 10, 15, 20 reporters to cover in everything that was going on in the show. And because of that, everybody knew what was going on within the tech landscape between those two sites and probably 10 other ones. But the pace of the reporting was really the incredible part. I mean, they were putting it sometimes, you know, 30, 40 stories a day. And when we say stories here, we're not talking about long form 3,000 word pieces. We're talking about, you know, summations of a new product. So David saw that model work and was like, listen, I'm really interested in a lot of product. There's no real outlet out there that's covering my perspective on this. There certainly were other sites that were covering sneakers, and certainly sneakers came out of forum culture, you know, old bulletin boards. But blogging as a platform allowed for David, myself, and others to begin to tell storytelling around product and sharing stories at a very specific clip. And what that meant from the High Snobiety lens was we were constantly, you know, on the internet, on forums, looking for the next great thing. We were, you know, subscribing to Japanese men's magazines and, you know, finding items and objects and products in Japan that were not available anywhere else, and we're covering it through those magazines. And then that led us, of course, to beginning to show up at runway shows and in marketplaces. So we were very much a news service at that point, and maybe even less editorial, certainly less editorial than we are today. But at that time, it was more about, you know, telling the world what was coming. Now, what was interesting is that tech got it. You know, the big tech companies understood the value of blogging at that point, but fashion did not. Fashion was not caught up with that, you know, and I remember getting letters from, you know, people that we're partners with today, you know, the Nikes of the world and a variety of brands that would say, hey, you know, you're sharing photographs of and previewing goods that are not going to be seen for 6 months. You know, this is detrimental to our communications plans. And, you know, they saw us in many ways as a threat. But what it really was, what I believe it helped show those brands is that, wow, there's an audience that actually is hungry for the stuff, and they want it to be served up to them at a much faster clip than it is today. And what we really tried to impress onto them is like, listen, just because we're showing it now doesn't mean when it hits the stores in 6 months, people are going to forget about it. In fact, I think they're going to desire it even more. And that was really what we were doing. We were very quick in competing with other properties in serving up the latest goods, the latest limited edition colorway. And a lot of it was very aspirational. Much of it could not be purchased on the internet. You couldn't simply, you know, go to a website the way we can today. You had to go and find it. So we were a guide in many ways to it. Now, you know, looking at 15 years, you know, today we're a much different property, and certainly within the last 6 months, we've become even more different. We're much more editorial and certainly are looking to be the voice of a young generation. And, you know, if you look at our coverage around everything that's happened from George Floyd to Breonna Taylor, we're now very much taking a stand and, you know, trying to be a voice for a community that wasn't expecting for us. And in many ways, we didn't believe that we could even talk to in this way. But what's been really crazy, maybe crazy is not the right word, but it's been really sort of eye-opening, is at the beginning of COVID, in the middle of COVID, in the middle of what was happening around Black Lives Matter and with George Floyd, I would ask people that I know, hey, is it cool for us to have this conversation? And it was almost like a demand. It was like, listen, you have to have this conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, you guys are the voice of an audience. You know, there's millions of young individuals that come to visit you every day and see you as a news source. And I'll be very honest, I think that was a moment where we didn't button up, but we were like, okay, if we're going to go into it, we're going to go into it full steam. And that's the approach we take.
So did the business model, go ahead. I'm sorry. I was just saying, did the business model change from there?
The business model did not change. I think the editorial perspective certainly did. In where we believed or felt like we were allowed to talk and talk about, that's for sure. You know, I believe, and I think, you know, there are certainly publications that have decided not to step into the conversation of what's happening today. But I do believe it's quite important for digital properties and certainly brands like ours to let our consumer know, you know, that we're with them and where we are with them. And I think that's one of the reasons why in thinking about High Snobiety in 2020, just how proud I am of our editorial team and certainly our editor-in-chief, Tom Bedridge, in taking the stands that we've taken. You know, I think a lot about, when the protests began to happen around George Floyd. You know, some of the stories that we felt to be important were, all right, how do we inform our readers who are protesting as to, you know, how to protect themselves maybe from tear gas? You know, that's a story that would have not existed on High Snobiety, you know, 15 years ago. But today, it's very much part of that conversation. And it's also okay to have that conversation. It's also okay to have the conversation around product alongside of, you know, this more important, these more important issues that are happening.
Fashion expresses what their feelings are. So it's just an extension of how they feel, and it's a voice.
Yeah. Awesome. You know, one aspect of the business that I certainly love that we've been really pushing on is the insight side of our business. You know, we've written a few white papers at this point. The first one being The New Luxury, which was really us wanting to understand exactly what luxury looked like in at that point, 2018. That paper's been in the works for quite some time. And, you know, a couple things came from that. You know, where luxury used to be defined maybe by dollar value or exclusivity, you know, it's completely different now. It's about access, and even though somebody may not be able to buy a specific luxury good, they still want access to it, right? The door is open now for them. And more than ever, what, you know, our work in that space has shown us, and we did another paper called The Immunized Shopper about two to three weeks into COVID. And what we found was that, you know, the young consumer today wants brands to, you know, evoke the same kind of sensibilities that they have, and they are willing to align themselves with brands that have shared, you know, shared viewpoints on the world. So, you know, I don't believe that a fashion brand can exist today without being part of the conversation. You know, yes, certainly there's basic brands and that can, you know, that can get by without raising their voice, but trust me, more and more, you know, the young consumer expects, if not demands, that the brands that they purchase from, the brands that they desire, are taking a stand somewhere in the world, and they want to know what that is.
And it seems like some of the luxury brands, because I want to talk about the cross-pollination with luxury brands and street fashion. You know, the whole streetwear culture has moved from mainstream over the course of the last decade, and it seems like this collaborative spirit that has permeated all aspects of culture has impacted streetwear and has led to this luxury streetwear. And Gucci and Louis Vuitton come to mind. So how did the worlds of high fashion and streetwear collide? And when was that tipping point?
I think that, so it's been there since day one. And we can look to brands like Stussy, which was originally a surf brand out of the West Coast, which has had likely the largest influence within the mainstream, even before the mainstream knew who they were, to Supreme Vuitton. So let's go back. You know, a brand like Stussy and brands like Fresh Jive and even a brand like Fuck, that's F-U-C-T. Mm-hmm. They actually just won a major Supreme Court landmark decision around copyright of their name. Well worth taking a look into that. That's F-U-C-T. These are brands that would parody what was happening in luxury. And actually, let me even rephrase that a little differently. They would pay homage to luxury by flipping luxury logos to represent themselves. You know, Stussy has a very famous Chanel logo flip. Supreme in the late 90s, 2000, I think it was the early 2000s, paid homage to Louis Vuitton by using their monogram on a skateboard, which they were, you know, sued for, set to cease and desist. So it's always been part of the conversation. In fact, on High Snobiety, if you look at some of the most early posts, you're finding us talking about sneakers in line with a conversation around a new Goyard wallet. And that's the vision that David had. And I think that's what set really high. And that's the thing that attracted me to High Snobiety was David's vision that was less, say, US centric, but much more European centric in how he saw these two objects existing together. And certainly the market didn't see it that way. It was not, you know, it was not cool to have a Nike product talking to, sitting next to a Balenciaga product, you know, 15 years ago, but we were certainly writing about it. And, you know, a lot of the streetwear brands at the time were, you know, flipping those logos and paying homage to what was happening. But I think the most recent, the moment and really the validating moment that showed us that these two worlds exist together is when Louis Vuitton worked with Supreme on their runway show and collaborative collection. And it's, I'll be very honest, as a journalist who's been writing about this culture for the better part of 20 years, it was literally, my hands were in the air. It was like, here we are. You know, we've been talking about the fact that these worlds have been converging forever. And what is a better indicator of it than Vuitton and Supreme working together? And I remember when that thing went down, the amount of conversation and sort of the explainer sessions I would have around it were just tremendous.
It seems like just Gucci and Louis Vuitton are the ones that have embraced this fully.
Gucci and Vuitton are two of the strongest players that have understood that speaking to a street fashion consumer is not about product, but about a mindset and an idea and an ideology of thought. You know, it's knowing that, you know, these two worlds can coexist, that the high and low can live together. You know, Gucci, to be honest, I think was even a little earlier than Vuitton by releasing the Gucci Ghost collection, which was done in collaboration with an artist named Trevor Andrew, also known as Trouble Andrew. He's a former pro snowboarder who was a musician who essentially was invited by Alessandro to go to a party, and he didn't have a Gucci piece, so he literally took a Gucci bedsheet, put it over his head, and you know the Gucci guys saw it and were like, we gotta do this, like let's work together. And I just want to stress on that, you know, Gucci and Vuitton, what they have been able to do better than most brands is communicate on the level that a young consumer, or at least a consumer that's that sees themselves as street ready in a way that no other brand has. So it's not just about product, it's about how they're able to communicate and connect with those consumers. And it can't be understated. I mean, Virgil Abloh at Louis Vuitton is not just about him being a creative director, which he is an incredible creative director, but about the fact that he understands how to energize youth culture. And, you know, if we look at the luxury market, you know, we use this year 2025 as a big one. You know, millennials and Gen Z demo, and I don't like talking about demos, I think the mindset's the important thing, but if we look at those two demos, they're gonna add half a trillion dollars in spending to the luxury market. And any brand that is not aware that that consumer is coming, you know, they're going to go by the wayside. And this goes back to what we know, the learnings that we've gotten from our white paper, is that today's young consumer demands the brands to talk to them, you know, and it's no longer a top-down conversation, you know, much more than ever. It's, you know, it's kind of looking at that audience and figuring out how to get to them correctly.
Do you think that the way that's going to be, especially for traditional luxury brands, is doing more of these partnerships and collaborations with street fashion? Because street fashion to me is democratizing luxury. And, you know, Gucci and Vuitton get it, and some of the other brands are trying. But do you think there needs to be more of a shift from these other traditional luxury brands who've never wandered into this space, or if they have done it poorly? If they're going to speak to this younger generation, they need to have more collaborations with brands that understand their mindset.
Yeah, so I don't so much think it has to be a collaboration with another brand as much as it is working with creatives that speak directly to that consumer set or that mindset, as we've said, you know. Collaborations, you know, they've really just become, you know, there's plenty of collaborations out. There's always a collaboration happening. And as I said, back in the day, it was a way of co-signing one brand or another. I think today the collaborative side has to be with the young creative set, be it a photographer, be it a stylist, be it a designer. That's the way to connect with what's happening, you know, and quote unquote the streets, right? That's what's happening at the ground level. That's the way to connect with it. And yeah, I think that I firmly do believe that there's luxury houses that haven't stepped into it, and they're perfectly fine not stepping into it. And many of those luxury houses actually haven't even stepped into digital yet. You know, right. They're still very, you know, old school in that sense. And quite honestly, that's kind of cool. You know, being able to just do your thing, lock it out, and keep going. But if you are going to enter the space, you have to enter it correct, because this young consumer is going to call you out faster than you can imagine, you know, and there's plenty of examples of that. And one thing I do want to add too, you know, just because a brand gets it wrong does not mean they can't get it right again. So I'm not a big fan of canceling somebody for getting it wrong the first time. I think you have to own up to it, accept it, embody it, and let people know that you're going to do better the next time. And I think that's okay. So I don't think it's just like a one-shot chance at getting it right. I just firmly believe that, you know, at the top level of these organizations, they just need more creatives and certainly more individuals that, yeah, understand what's happening at street level.
Yeah, and one of the areas that it seems like some of these forward-thinking luxury brands are doing is they're getting into the gaming industry lately. Sure. To the Gen Z millennial audience, you know, brands like Marc Jacobs and Valentino created these virtual outfits for Animal Crossing.
Right, right.
And, you know, it seems like the gaming market is too big to ignore right now, for any brand to ignore. So do you see bigger opportunities for luxury and street fashion brands to be part of the gaming experience?
You know, you've mentioned too, I'll throw in Vuitton making the League of Legends trophy box, right? You know, Louis Vuitton has made... you know, they've made the World Cup trophy box in the past. And, you know, they've entered that space. I look at it this way, you know, more than ever, IP is in the hands of the consumer to, you know, recreate with, right? And when you look at the digital world, the flex there is just as important as the flex on the streets. What I mean by that is, you know, you see somebody walking down the street with a very hot pair of sneakers, you know, they want that same experience within gaming. You know, we were talking about just yesterday, GTA 5, where, you know, some creators have gone as far as like learning how to code in that environment to recreate, you know, real world objects so they can wear within that environment, you know. Some people would see it as a reappropriation of IP. I see it as an homage. You know, it's the fans, it's the consumer taking it into their hands. And yeah, that's, you're absolutely right. You know, it's the digital world, or as, you know, some people like to call the metaverse, the metaverse, this world where, you know, there's this avatar like person that represents, character or thing that represents you. It very much also wants to represent what you're into and the objects that you own. So there's absolutely no doubt about it. And to be, you know, very transparent, these are conversations that we're having every day. You know, the gaming industry is very much wanting to tap into it. The gaming consumer, it may not even, you know, there is overlap with luxury and certainly with streetwear, more so with street fashion. And yeah, everyone's trying to get a foothold in it. And yeah, it's the next territory or the next breakthrough area.
Yeah. Another interesting area is the online auctions, like the traditional auction houses like Christie's and Sotheby's. I think it was back in July, Stadium Goods and Christie's hosted this online sale of 11 lots
for sure.
of one-of-a-kind, historically significant Air Jordans, you know, the Nike Airship and some other ones.
In fact, I think there's one happening right now. There's actually another Sotheby's auction happening currently.
Oh, really? That other sale brought in like $1 million. So do you see auction houses like Christie's and Sotheby's, now that they're sort of getting a taste of this and it's getting a lot of buzz and obviously bringing in a lot of money, do you see them moving away from more traditional fine art categories to court younger buyers?
Traditional fine art, I think, is the key phrase there. You know, more than ever, the objects that encompass this world, you know, they are seen as art objects in many ways. I think one of the moment that was really eye-opening to me was when I opened up a Christie's catalog around a Supreme sale, and there was their version of the Hermes ashtray, which I am looking at right now on my desk, and to see it inside of a Christie's auction catalog blew me away, you know. And, you know, I think one thing that we have to really think about is perceived scarcity of a lot of these goods, right? Because, you know, sort of that Warhol pop play here, you know, can traditional objects in the world be seen as art? And, you know, I'm sure we can have hours of conversation or a whole nother podcast on that topic, but in our eyes, yes. You know, the same way that art, and by the way, art, many art collectors and critics will tell you that this may be a moment. I'm not sure it is a moment. I think that the art world coming into it and seeing the valuation of some of these items is quite important. So the skateboard sale, the Supreme skateboard sale comes to mind. You know, there are people that collect these things, the same way that people collect Pokemon cards, to be honest, and same way that people collect, you know, Helmut Lang garments or Raf Simons garments. You know, there's so many archivists that are doing that. And I think that beyond the objects themselves, this is their gateway into that younger consumer who, in my mind, I believe that they're trying to convert into a fine art collector. You know, maybe you start with that Supreme Hermes ashtray, and next thing you know, you're moving up the chain and buying, you know, what traditional fine art is. And I think that's the goal, right? Just like every other industry, the art industry is looking to court a new consumer. We know they have spending power. They're certainly willing to spend. And this is certainly one gateway to get them in there.
Last year, High Snobiety ventured into the e-commerce space and launched with this exclusive deal to carry a Prada line. So what is unique about High Snobiety's retail strategy? And do you look at commerce as a big revenue play for the brand?
Commerce is certainly, yeah, I mean, we have our eyes on commerce big time. The Prada was the first, indeed, the first collection that we did launch. It was the Linea Rossa collection that they were rebooting. It's interesting because the Prada collection was it was expensive. You know, there were a lot of those products were over $1,000. And why would Prada work with us? I think it's, you know, we saw it as us being like, look, if you thought we were going to be about sneakers, this is bigger than that. So let's start with, you know, let's set the bar high and show the world what we believe the consumer is looking for, and certainly what the consumer is looking for from us. What makes our commerce proposition different than a traditional outlet? Number one is the audience. You know, there's a tremendous number of readers, that millions of people that come to us every day to look at goods. Mm-hmm. And we're very good storytellers. In fact, I think we're excellent storytellers. The lens that we use and the lens that we shoot through quote unquote, is very specific. It's why our readers come back to us day in and day out. They want the perspective through our lens. So when we work with a Prada or Montclair or quite honestly a Nike, you know, what makes us different is how we present those products and the stories that we tell around them. So we're not just putting product online as a drop. You know, we're preheating or teasing those goods for quite some time with exceptional storytelling. Sometimes it's going into a factory. Well, there's plenty of factory videos out there. We'll tell it a different way, you know. And we do our best to connect the high dots with also things that are accessible. So one thing that I don't know if you saw with the product collection, it still blows our mind that we're able to get Prada to allow us to do this, but we actually developed Prada packing tape. So, you know, the Linea Rossa collection has a very specific red, a red line that says Prada within it. And we produced a few hundred rolls of essentially Prada packing tape that we seeded out as a teaser for that collection sale. What we could not do was sell the packing tape, but the packing tape became the identifier for it. What's really cool to me is that that packing tape does not have the Heist & Bidey name on it, but people know that that came from us, you know? And I'll be very honest, it became our mark for some time, and it helped us open so many more doors, you know? So when we're releasing a high-end collection, and by the way, we just don't sell high-end goods, you know, we definitely look at the high and low and believe that they can live in the same space, and certainly the middle ground is also there. We love to have fun with, you know, a packing tape or, you know, we worked with Nike on a HyperAdapt, which is a self-lacing sneaker. You know, we sent a lot of friends and people of influence, you know, a bag of laces saying, hey, look, like the shoe doesn't need laces anymore. Show us what you can do with these laces. And, right. You know, so much art came from that. So I think the mechanisms and the strategy that we use in promoting a collection sale is quite unique. And I think that is what sets us apart and certainly why these brand partners come to us and continue to come back to us.
Yeah. And you recently partnered with Boston Consulting Group on one of the studies. I know you've done several studies and white papers to this most recent one. I think it was Culture, Culture, Culture. Takes a closer look at the new definition of luxury and what matters most to new fashion luxury consumers, you know, particularly Gen Z and millennials. And the report says, and I take this from the report, it says, brands that are successful in this new environment do not simply respond to trends or outside narratives, but instead become true drivers of culture. So are you saying that brands need to achieve cultural credibility to drive growth? And how can brands start doing that?
Yeah, cultural credibility is very much the soul and heart of culture. It's, you know, it's something that we've been trying to define and work on for quite some years. You know, our relationship with BCG is very strong. You know, we've been talking to them for years and have quite a relationship with them. And when the opportunity came up, I want to say it was over a year ago, because I've been working on the culture paper for some time. You know, it was amazing that an organization as large as BCG, and for those that don't know Boston Consulting Group, you know, they're a massive, you know, agent, you know, not an agency, they're a practice in many ways. Yeah. You know, the brands go to them to help them figure out everything. So, but what they understood, you know, I think it's sort of a two-way street. Like they were able to bring us quite a wide purview, you know, with their research insights and certainly the scope at which they're able to work at. And what they couldn't get themselves was sort of the niche consumer that we were reaching, right? I always like to say, you know, the consumer that reads Heist & Bidey within our world is not so easy to get to, right? And they're not traditionally somebody that fills out a survey to answer questions. Well, we have quite some number of readers that allow us to survey them, oftentimes without even us, say, giving them a free iPad, as you see most surveys. They just want to give back so that, quite honestly, we can serve them better and so the market can serve them better. So cultural credibility is the idea that, you know, there are, and I think if you've looked at the paper, there's this idea of table stakes. You know, there are about seven things that every brand has to do today to even be in a conversation, you know, and I think you know what those are. You know, it's responsibility, it's sustainability, mm-hmm. it's quality. But then as you go down farther down, there's all of these other dynamics that are involved and play into it. You know, how does a consumer learn about a product? Is it through an IRL in real life experience, or is it, you know, through traditional media, or is it going into a multi-brand retail store or a direct retail store? And we cover all the bases there with BCG's help in really helping to identify all of those things. What I'll say about cultural credibility as well is part of being credible is, again, in how you talk and how you're communicating to that audience. And the paper is a guideline to it. I think every brand, number one, has to remain strong to who they are, their vision, their mission. But that should be a guiding light as to how they decide to talk to a consumer set. And, the second part of the paper that's also interesting is this, you know, pathway of commerce, the consumer pathway and how they buy things. And one of the insights that came from is that a tremendous number of consumers, especially young consumers, make a decision to buy a product even before they enter a store or go to an online shop. They've already made up their mind. Well, how have they gotten to that decision? The paper goes into quite some insight into that. You know, it's part of this discovery and research phase that quite honestly sometimes gets forgotten about, because, you know, today commerce is so transactional. The focus is on getting somebody to put something into their basket and then reminding them it's there. Well, you know, we believe in the research that we have with the folks at BCG show that discovery and research point, and I will say that's probably where traditional marketing exists, that stuff is quite important, as is, you know, the people, the cohorts that you hang with. You know, you young consumers today learn so much from their friends and from the people that they follow on social media, and that stuff's important. And it's not just about an influencer. You know, we talk about another type of player called a cultural pioneer. And I think one of the easiest ways to think about a cultural pioneer is maybe with this example. You know, if you are a cosmetics or a makeup YouTuber, you're probably pretty good at telling stories about how to put on lipstick, how to take care of your skin, the cosmetics to use, the products you use. But are you able to tell somebody what car to buy? Are you able to tell somebody what water to drink? I don't know. You know, a cultural pioneer is somebody that's able to touch a variety of things and influence in a way that goes beyond just one lane. And those cultural pioneers are who we talk to at High Sobriety. And they're not the ones that show up on the charts. You know, in fact, you know, many of them don't have a million followers. Some of them have, you know, 5, 10, 15, 50,000 followers. And that's a really interesting place to play. But these individuals are the ones that can, you know, cause a groundswell of reaction to a product or a service. So
essentially they influence the influencers.
Exactly. And they're very difficult to find. And there's not that many of them out there. You know, if Virgil Abloh comes to mind, you know, he can touch a variety of different things because his design language just resonates across so well. You know, if he touches an Evian bottle and a Vuitton purse, you know, it's his each time. You know, there's very few designers that have that resonance. And, you know, he's certainly not the only one. There's certainly others out there. But the cultural pioneer is certainly somebody that we're very focused on and believe that a brand should be thinking a lot about.
You were recently on Digiday's The New Normal show talking about the business of hype, and we were talking about the drop strategy before, and you said hype is a moment, and what we're trying to do is build a movement where a brand just doesn't come out with a one-hit wonder, but a brand that has a conversation with a consumer set that we, you know, the consumer set that we reach. Can you talk about that a little more?
You know, I'll use Balenciaga as a quick example, and then I'll talk a little bit more about it. So, you know, the Triple S, which was a very iconic you know, ugly sneaker, as a lot of people used to call it, or, you know, sort of this big fat shoe that started sort of this bulky trend within footwear. You know, it became a very hype product for Balenciaga. And there was a consumer that went to Balenciaga specifically for that product. Because of that, what we were saying to those guys, you know, conversations is, how can this hype sneaker become a gateway to the rest of what you're doing, right? So that triple S shoe is what got people into the door that may not normally go into a Balenciaga. And then it's really up to the brand to harness the power of that to convert that consumer, in the Balenciaga example, into a future consumer. So hype is, in many ways, to a lot of people, a flash moment, where we believe it should not be just a moment. It should be a way of getting a consumer that may not be familiar with the products that you have or the services that you offer to come in and see the rest of it. Otherwise, quite honestly, it's worthless. You know, I don't know a single brand that just wants somebody to come in and buy one product and leave. And the truth is that a lot of hype product is that. It's sort of this one hit wonder, and then you forget about the brand. But the brands that are doing it right, and I think the brands that are going beyond the hype, and that just sounds super cliche for me to say, but for brands that are taken to the next level, they are understanding how to, you know, quote unquote, grab that consumer so that they can see everything else that they offer.
Yeah, would you say Telfar is one of those, you know, with that bag security system that they did?
I think the bag is certainly a hype bag, 100%. And I think what they're trying to do, what I think is quite interesting, is that, and what he's certainly trying to do is make that bag absolutely accessible by everyone, right? They want everyone to be able to get their hands on that bag rather than just a small subset of people. But yes, that bag is hype. You know, where it becomes something of a classic is when, you know, people continue to talk about it. In terms of what makes something a classic, I don't have a timeline for what that is. But that's sort of that's what you want it to turn into, right? You want it to become an instant classic. That's really the end goal. But I, you know, listen, we High Sobriety covers hype day in and day out. You know, that's the energy that drives consumers to come every day. They want to see something that they didn't see yesterday, you know? And there was a time when they would forget about it. You know, they consume it, they move on to the next thing. And that is the hype cycle, right? Something's hot today, and then tomorrow there's something else. I think what makes a brand stand out, a brand that has legs to remain there, is to be able to harness that and convert that customer not just into a shopper that grabs one bag or one pair of shoes, but somebody that's coming in, someone that continues to come, you know, back to see what you have next. And maybe they're not coming every day or every week, but, you know, they're coming back. And I think the drop model very much plays into that, right? You know, the old model of, or this traditional model of the fashion schedule is that you would have a seasonal release, and, you know, the shop people would call their clientele and say, come on in, and clientele would pick 20 items and they'd walk out. Well, what brings them back in? You know, that's the value of the drop. The drop allows for them to, over the course of a season, and I mean, seasons are kind of gone the way of the dodo at this point. But season, you know, what's a season? I think now more than ever, the drop is that it's not showing all your cards at once and leaving something else to be desired. And part of that is, quite honestly, to ensure that the consumer returns, you know, week in, week out, or you know, every Saturday.
So what's next to conquer for High Sobriety?
Editorially, we're very focused on ensuring that we are putting shine and elevating new young creatives more than we ever have. And that's really important. And how we elevate those creatives is by supporting not only the products that they develop and the services that develop, but the causes that they stand behind, and offering them a platform, a place to have their voice heard. You know, that to me is the most exciting part of our editorial. You know, we have we've made a conscious effort to double down, if not triple down, on what we believe to be right, just causes. And we want to ensure that our consumer knows about that stuff from us as well. Certainly they can go to other properties and other websites, maybe even traditional media, to learn about those issues or those causes. But we believe that we can bring a very specific perspective to them. And, you know, we believe that we also know how to talk to them in a way that you know, resonates. So we're going to continue to be very active, not just on the product front, but also on the cost front. And, you know, right now voting, regardless of what party or which direction you want to vote, you know, that's a very big issue right now. We need, you know, young consumers and I'm talking about, you know, people in the United States right now, or those that are allowed to vote in the United States, because it's a whole nother issue. But, you know, they've traditionally not been the ones to show up to the polls.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I'm hoping that changes this year.
It's massive. It's massive. And we're doing, you know, everything in our power to get people to actually do that. And more importantly, especially in, states where a vote may count more than others. You know, I think about New York City, you know, my vote may not be as, by the way, my vote's important, but, you know, I think there's a lot more like-minded individuals such as myself that are putting a vote here. So I have a feeling I know where the direction is going to go. But how about that kid in a town, or that young adult in a town that, you know, they see their local leaders, you know, not sort of having the same sensibilities as them or the same viewpoints as them? That's where this is important, you know, having those voices heard. And what's even more important, you know, I'm 45 years old. I'm a Gen Xer. You know, I was part of a generation that was told that we were slackers and you can't listen to punk rock. You can't, what do you know about politics, you know? And today it's so important and so much part of the conversation, because the truth is, you know, the young kids don't want me talking down to them. You know, and when I say me, I mean people of my generation. They need to rise up and show the world that, you know, they are the next generation. You know, I have a phrase I like to use a lot, which is believe in the youth of today. And what I mean by that is, for as crazy as the world is, I firmly believe that, the young population is the future of this country and certainly the future of the world. And more than ever, instead of looking up to mentors, they look horizontally to all of their friends, and they want to rise up together. That's amazing. You know, that is amazing. I was told I needed a mentor to kind of guide me and show me the way. You know what, today they need guidance, but they look to one another to kind of rise up together. And that to me is so paramount to the future, not only of the world, but, you know, of how we live.
Yeah. So my final question to you, which is the luxury item question, which I ask all my guests.
Uh-oh.
If you were stranded on a desert island and you could only have one luxury item, what would that luxury item be? It can't be any form of transportation, of course, and it can't require anything that requires mobile service. What would that one single luxury item be?
Wow. You know, it's funny. I didn't even think about this question, and I should have. I knew you were going to ask this too. You know, there's a brand out of Japan called Snow Peak, and they are, and this is such a, I feel like this is, this answer is so me in some ways. They make such premium outdoor gear. You know, they make titanium and bamboo stoves and cots. It would have to be a Snow Peak tent, you know, but a Snow Peak tent, just because I know I'd be safe in it, and the thing could take a blizzard, or it could take a monsoon. But if you want a traditional luxury item that I would take with me.
No, not at all. It's whatever your definition. That was a good answer. The first thing I
like Snow Peak a lot. And I highly recommend people check them out. And I think there's a lot of people that would not, in the traditional definition of luxury, see Snow Peak as a luxury brand. But I think to an average consumer, when they see the quality of that product and the, you know, and really the price point of it, they'll see it. I love Snow Peak. I think they make amazing things. So okay, it'd be so, a Snow Peak tent.
So we will find you on a tent when we send out an airplane to look for you. So we'll look for that tent. Any particular color we should be looking for?
No, it'll say SOS Scott. So you can see it.
Jeff, thank you so much for being on The Luxury Item. Extremely informative. I learned a lot. I'm sure our listeners learned a lot. So again, thank you so much for coming on.
Scott, thank you so much.
That's it for this episode of the Luxury Item Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you found this useful and entertaining, I would be really grateful if you can share it with a friend or colleague. I would love it if you subscribe so you never miss an episode. And while you're there, be sure to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other listeners find us. The Luxury Item Podcast is a production of Silvertone Consulting. I'm your host, Scott Kerr. Until next time.